Welcome to Silence the Mind Cluck. I'm your host, Maria T. Finch, and I'm super glad that you're here. Get ready to quiet that mind and reap the rewards.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I'm thrilled to have Carrie Prejean with me here today. Carrie, welcome.
Hey, good morning, Maria. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so happy to have you. So please introduce yourself.
I'm Carrie Prejean from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Prejean, pardon me for mispronouncing that.
It's all right. I get called a lot worse. So okay. I'm a CPA. I do CFO consulting. I'm also a certified ontological coach. And I use that in my executive coaching along with the CFO consulting. Right now, I have clients in the U.S., and I'm kind of interested in branching out into the English-speaking world.
Oh, great. Okay. So first thing I got to ask you about is tell us all about, how do you say it?
Ontological.
Ontological.
Yeah, it's the ontology of language. It was a discipline that was put together mostly by a gentleman named Fernando Flores from Chile. Brilliant guy. He reads like a few books a week. And I've met him. He's really brilliant. And what he did is, he put together this discipline that made some claims. And one of the claims is that language is generative, not just descriptive. And what does that mean? That means that our reality, our perception is generated by the language that we have going on up here, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, your perspective is your reality. Right. We don't have a direct biological experience of life like animals do. Animals, they have all these, and they just get a direct experience. They don't have any judgment. They don't have any language about it. Us, we're pattern seeking, right? We're pattern seeking, and we're always trying to make sense out of what's happening to us. And depending on the perspective or the narrative that you live in, that's going to dictate a lot of what you experience or a lot of what the story you make up about what happened. In other words, there's event and then there's interpretation, and they're not the same thing, right?
Yes. Okay.
So that's one way language is generative. Another way language is generative is that this present that you and I are in right now happened in language a few weeks ago. That makes sense?
So it doesn't. Explain that in a little more detail.
The fact that you and I are here talking right now in the same place about this topic happened in a conversation of, hey, I'd like to be on your show, and hey, fill this out, and back and forth. Oh, yeah, hey. So this moment was invented in language in the past.
That's fascinating.
So if you don't like what's been happening, you don't like your current present, you don't like your current state, you need to change your language to create a different future. And future is invented in three speech acts. There's request, there's offers, and there's promises. And a promise really is an acceptance of either an offer or a request. But it creates a future event, right? I mean, something as simple as some kid coming up and saying, hey, can I mow your grass? It's Saturday for $20. I'll mow your lawn. Okay, great. Saturday morning shows up, mows the lawn, you pay him $20, complete. What happens if he says, hey, I'd like to come mow your grass. It's Saturday, I charge you $20. And he doesn't show up.
Okay.
Now you've got a different identity of this kid. You're starting to get that he's unreliable, doesn't keep his promises. Or what if he shows up to the half-assed job mowing your lawn and then tries to charge you $30.
Okay.
That's a different, you're going to begin to have a different identity of him. And our identity, despite as much as we think we know who we are, actually lives in the people who see us in action. Right?
Okay. Oh, this is a fascinating perspective.
So,
okay. So
that's another way language is generative, is that it creates a future, it creates, your perspective. And so where do you get all this stuff? Mm-hmm. You pick it up along the way growing up. You get it from your parents, your family, your school, your friends, society. And now we've got the internet and we've got, my father thought it was a crime that as much TV as we watched. We didn't watch that much TV, but he calls it boob tube. Now I have grandchildren that are glued to their iPads.
Right.
And that's not reality. I mean, you've probably been in a restaurant where you've seen families come in. Everybody's got the iPhone. Instead of having a conversation around the table, everybody's on the iPhone. In fact, I've seen a couple at dinner texting each other across the table and just talking. So the technology is wonderful and to some extent, it has disconnected us from other people.
Yes.
In a genuine firsthand way.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah.
One of the other claims about, let me back up a little bit. The ontology of language, what is that? It's ontology comes from two words. Ontos is the Greek word, which means to be. And ology, of course, is the study of. So it's a study of being in language. And that's what Fernando claimed, is that we're in, you know, this thing of all these prejudices, right, wrong, good, bad, make sense, don't make sense, all that stuff that's going on all the time and is telling you what you're seeing and what you're experiencing. It's giving you a prejudiced outcome, prejudiced interpretation of what just happened. It's going on so much we don't even notice it. Except if you stop and listen to it right now, it's telling you right now, is this making sense? Is this good, bad, right? Does this guy make, whatever it is. You can't put it down. You can't stop. You can't say, I'm not going to have language right now. It's going to go on. I dare you to not have that. You know, the example that Simon Sinek has, he says, you can't hold a negative. Don't think of a blue elephant. Well, you think of a blue elephant. Right. So this other thing about language is that since your perspective is your reality, you have to be careful who controls your perspective.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? What controls that controls reality. So if you're tuned in to, say, one side of the political spectrum or the mainstream media, either left or right, you're going to be controlled by that. You're going to see from that lens, so to speak.
Yes.
It's going to be hard for you to see not from that lens.
Correct.
Well, let me say it this way. Whatever perspective you have, you're blind to others. So the thing I run into a lot with the business owners that I work with who are entrepreneurs are, I mean, you can characterize them by a few things. I mean, not exclusively, but generally they're very optimistic. They like taking risks. They don't see them as risks. They see them as capturing opportunities. They're all about taking action, getting things done, making things happen. They're impatient with the world. They don't see why the rest of the world doesn't see what they see, right? So from that perspective, they rarely take a good risk assessment. And they have most of them have a very hard time with people in their organization say, well, have you thought about this? And what about this risk? We need to get that insured. We need to cover it, get that covered. Is that a different occupation we're going to have to do something with in the workman's comp policy? And that drives them crazy. Like, why are you bothering with all these negatives? They're not bothering you with all those negatives. They're having you take a look at risks that could come back and bite you in the ass. And I've seen it happen where they don't appreciate, oh yeah, that could be a problem. And it comes back, it's like, oh, you got a big insurance claim. You should listen to your insurance contract manager when she was trying to tell you about this. Anyway.
So how do you relate this to your personal life? So we all have the voices in our minds that are telling us, you know, positive and negative things. And I'm particularly focused on mind cluck. So the negative things, the things that inhibit us or, you know, make us not go for something or feel bad or whatever. So how do you relate that in this construct?
Oh, very, very easily. In the ontology of language, there's this concept called the anyone self. Okay. You know, it's sort of broad general statements. Anyone would see or no one would do that. Or, yeah, well, you know, the kind of go with the crowd kind of mentality without really taking an examination. And a lot of that stuff drives you. And a lot of it's just chatter. Yeah. And like I said, it's been there for so long, you don't even notice it. It's kind of like, you know, it's back here. I mean, I can see it on the screen, but I can't see it from here. You can see it. Everybody else watching this can see it. I can't see it from my eyes, right? Uh-huh. Well, everybody can see it but you. So what you have to do is learn to become an observer of this. You have to learn what this is and examine these out here to where you can say, oh, this is just an opinion I picked up at one time. Uh-huh. You know, can I reinterpret it some kind of way? Because it's an opinion based on from some perspective. Take it from a different perspective becomes a different opinion or an evaluation or judgment or whatever you want to call it. Right. Especially and the ones that have us suffer are the ones that we hold really dear, like they're the truth. Yeah. And they're really just an opinion, right? But we hold them like they're the truth. In fact, we hold them so, what's the word? Sacredly, so close to our heart that we're like terrified to examine that. Oh, it's just an opinion.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's
and
so true.
And a good ontological coach doesn't tell you what to think, but a good ontological coach will ask you questions to have you examine those things that you suffer from and maybe come up with a different interpretation that empowers you rather than disempowers you. In every event, depending on your interpretation, you can either have it empower you, or you can have it disempower you, or you can have it work for you or not work for you. You can have it, you know, the event is the event. Your interpretation is your own. So learning how to interpret or intervene on the already at hand narrative is what's going to empower you. It's going to get you out of suffering. And it's going to put you in a better mood. And moods are really powerful. Emotions, okay. Not so much. Emotions come and go, but the mood you predominantly live in or the moods you predominantly live in have a huge impact on the way you see the world.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
So, let me give you an example. So if you live in, you know, what we call moods of ambition and great gratitude and joy and peace, the horizons that are available to you are pretty big. I mean, you can see pretty far out. You see all kinds of possibilities out there, right?
Yes.
And the range of action available to you is also pretty wide. You can do a whole lot of things in those moods. You see a lot of possibilities, take a lot of different actions.
Yes.
Conversely, if you live in moods of resentment and resignation, which are predominantly about, you know, such and such is happening to me that's negative, so-and-so is doing it to me, God, life, my parents, whatever. Doing it to me, you know, and there's nothing I can do about it. And that's the clincher with both of those moves. There's nothing I can do about it. Uh-huh. If there's nothing you can do about it, why take action? You know,
right.
You learn to be helpless and you learn to be a victim. And that becomes your raison d'etre, as they say, you know, becomes your reason to be. It becomes your story. And you're always, and you probably know some people like this and they're victims and it's about this and about that. And it's nonstop. And you know, and so basically they're pessimistic on top of it. The meta mood is pessimism. The moods you see most often are resignation and resentment. And the added bonus of resentment is, and someday I promise I'll get even.
Uh-huh.
I'll get back. So in those moods, in that conversation, that perspective, your range of action and your horizons is pretty limited.
You know, yeah.
You're pretty much limited to being a victim. And having excuses, why not, why I couldn't, why I didn't, and how it's prevented, and it's not my fault. Because that's what the narrative is going to be about.
Right. So can I give you a scenario and then you work your magic on it? So say, okay, so say that I've launched a business and it's not, you know, it's not happening as fast as I want it to, or I see all these hurdles or whatever. And what the voices in my head are saying is, you know, you're never going to be a good entrepreneur. You weren't cut out for this. This isn't really your right gig. How would you approach something like that? Like what are the steps that you would suggest to start unpacking that and changing those, you know, that narrative?
Right. Well, first I would ask, what was it that had you want to get into business in the first place? What was the opportunity that you saw?
Uh-huh.
Was that something you were passionate about?
Uh-huh.
You know, because it's easy. It's, you know, in business, starting a business is really tough. And most people think, you start a business, you make money, go, you know, get a big bank account. And it's not. You get knocked down. Because starting a business is generally because you're good at something. You're good at making money for somebody else. That, hey, I can make money for me doing this, right?
Yeah.
So you go out and get out there. And the thing is, there's so much about business you don't know if you're like good at sales, good at manufacturing, good at construction, good at wholesaling, that kind of stuff. But you don't know about how to do an organization, about taxes, about licensing and fees and competition and bank, all that stuff that most business owners know very little to nothing about and really don't like knowing about it.
Uh-huh.
You get out there and you get kicked in the teeth constantly. And it's easy to forget what you were originally committed to. So the question I would ask is, what were your original commitments? You know, what was your original vision? How passionate were you about that? And, you know, this breakdowns happen for everybody.
Sure.
So here's another question. When these breakdowns happen, what'd you do with them? Did you have a network of support? Have you built a repertoire of competencies that you can address these things? Do you have people identified for these different kinds of breakdowns that you can go to for help? Because having a network is going to make you much more powerful than you trying to do it all yourself, especially in stuff that you don't know what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
Accounting, taxes, banking. If you don't know what you're doing there, you need to get somebody who does.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and network with them, maybe pay them, you know, depending on what the relationship is. But it's like, it's easy to, you know, let me say it this way. it's easy to come up with reasons why not rather than results you say you were committed to. Okay. Reasons why not are much easier. And if you're not that, and the other thing, you have to be right. So what are you committed to? Or what were you committed to that now you say your commitment is wavering? Is that what you're telling me, your commitment is wavering? And what is it to be committed? What does that mean? The best definition I've ever heard of commitment is, I accept no excuse that this does not happen.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
When you're that committed, all the problems go away. You're going to find your way around them, through them, get help to get rid of them, eliminate them. When you're committed that you accept no excuse that this does not happen, you find ways to make it happen. So if you're questioning it, it could just be, you know, you've been beaten up so much lately, you're questioning all that. You're questioning your commitment. But if you're constantly, you know, maybe there's some self-worth issues of, you know, I'm not good enough, because a lot of people live with that. I'm not good enough. We picked that up from our parents. I'm not good enough. I'm stupid. I'm not loved. I'm not lovable. You know, all those kinds of things. So a good coach can help you get to the root of some of that.
Yes.
And re-inspire you to be, you know, be committed to your commitments rather than to your nonsense, and be committed to your excuses. Why not? Does that make sense?
It does. So for you personally, do you ever get messages of doubt about yourself?
I'm human.
And so what do you do with those?
I quickly remember. That's an excuse. I've been at this game a long time, right? And even though I've been at it a long time, I'm not perfect. I don't constantly, I'm not always an observer of the observer I am. I'm not always clear on this stuff, but I've practiced it so much for so long, I can quickly catch when I'm falling into some suffering trap, you know, I'm falling into some suffering. But I don't suffer much. I don't suffer long. When I see that I'm suffering, I get out of it real quick. Because in suffering, you don't do anything. You just suffer.
Yeah, yeah, that's so true. Do you have any tips about how to shift where you are in a moment? So say you're in a moment and you're just like, you're frustrated. So whether it's you're in a bad mood, or you say that your mind is telling you you're never going to get this done, like, what would you do with those? Do you have any tips that our audience could use?
Well, because our language lives in our biology, right? I mean, when you get embarrassed, you feel flushed. When you get angry, you know, you have visceral reactions that happen first in language and then show up in the biology.
Yes.
So your moods is connected to the biology. So one of the things you can do to shift your mood is music.
Yeah.
You know, music is a great mood shifter if you're willing to be open to it. Now, if you're just totally shut down, like, I ain't gonna play any music, it's not gonna do you any good. But here's a question that I start with when I start working with business owners about strategic planning. I have two questions. Are you satisfied with the way your business is? Are you satisfied with where it's headed? Okay. And the answer I normally get is, yeah, I mean, I guess so, kind of where it is. I'm not really sure where it's headed. And I had a mentor ask me a question, it's probably, I don't know, 30 years ago. He said, do you want to know the secret of life? I said, absolutely. He says, get exactly what you want. Be ultimately satisfied. It's like, okay. And he goes, and you know what the secret that is? He says, why don't most people have that? Because they never ask. They never take the time. They don't know what they want. So a big part of figuring out what's going to satisfy you, what you're going to, in terms of you getting ultimately what you want out of life, is taking the time to find out what that is, to discover what that is. And it requires time. It requires practice. It requires finding a lot of, you know, trying a bunch of different things and finding out, hey, I really don't like that. You know, it's kind of like relationships, you know, where you first start dating. For me personally, is I found out really quick, I don't like crazy. At all, crazy drama is like, ew. So you want to date somebody who's like life of the party, a lot of fun. You want to date somebody, you know, what works for you, works best for you in terms of the quiet, whatever. All the different combinations of. When you're dating, you find out a lot about. You find different types of personalities of people that, you know, they don't really work with you, and then finally you find somebody. Man, it clicks. Uh-huh. So same thing in business, same thing in life. You have to be willing to take the action. You have to take the risk. You have to find out what works, what doesn't work. And when you find something empowering, stick with it. When you find something disempowering, shed it as fast as you can, or change your narrative and maybe turn it into something in that that can empower you in a way.
Go ahead.
That's the point, all right. The tip is to be real clear. When you focus on, you spend a lot of time, when you get very clear about exactly what you want in life, it's going to be hard for you to get dissuaded from that very much. You know, I mean, there'll be times when you'll get down, you might have a string of disappointments and it's like, get back to what you say you're committed to. Get back to what you say is going to satisfy you and begin taking action. The biggest suffering trap is that you do nothing, because that's what suffering has to do, has you stop.
Yeah.
It's only in taking action, it's only in moving forward that you're going to maintain a positive mood, you're going to maintain results. You know, what you're going to develop is the habit of rigor and discipline. And rigor and discipline means that you're willing to practice, you're willing to participate, even when you don't feel like it. I'm not feeling it today. The weather's not nice, whatever. I have a cold. I have an ache in my back, whatever. Uh-huh. Just keep taking action, because what you'll find is once you start taking action, it becomes easier. The naysaying that goes on in your head goes away in just taking physical action.
So if you become aware that you have a narrative that is causing you to suffer, what's the first step for shifting that narrative?
Well, I think it's probably almost impossible to do any kind of major transformation without a good coach.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I was wondering your perspective on that, because that's one of the things that I
think. This is not a book you can read and you know, it takes practice. It takes practice in front of a coach. And people say, well, why do I need a coach? Why can't I just, you know, figure it out by myself? If you think about it, the top athletes in the world at all levels have coaches, many coaches. They don't just have one. They have many coaches for all the different things. And why do we need coaches? To improve our performance. Right. Because you can't see yourself perform.
Right.
Impossible. You can't see yourself in the act of doing whatever it is you're doing. A good coach not only can observe what you're doing and give you pointers, tips, whatever, how to do better, they also, because they've been around the game so long, have real fine distinctions to not just improve your game a little bit, but to increase it a lot.
Right.
You know, to make you much more effective. And I mean, this discipline of the ontology of language is one of those things of distinctions where you begin to get some distinctions in language and you begin to interrupt the anyone self, the automatic narrative, the automatic perception of the world. And you start to question things. You start to, when you find yourself suffering, again, with practice over time with a good coach, you begin to intervene in the suffering yourself to where you don't suffer near as long. The place you'll always find yourself in suffering, if you look at, you know, depressed people, sad people, they don't take action. They're immobilized in their mood and their sadness and their despair and their depression. So it's not going to get any better from you, with you staying there. You have to move. You have to take action. You have to be committed to something bigger than yourself.
Yeah.
Period.
Okay. I think that is a perfect thing for us to end on. So for everyone listening, if you're watching the video, you'll see a scroll of a website to contact Carrie. And for everyone listening, this will all be in the show notes. Do you have any last words of wisdom for our audience, Carrie?
I mean, again, we already talked about it a little bit. The biggest thing is to really make it a lifetime practice of asking yourself, what will satisfy me? What will satisfy me in business and money and relationships, my own dignity, play, body, spirituality, all that. When you have a real clear path about what will satisfy you, it's easy to, you're going to be motivated to take action. You will. You'll be motivated to go out and get all that. It's going to be hard to stay and suffer.
Yeah, that, I think that's so true. That's great. Thank you so much for your time today, Carrie.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Maria. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. To our listeners, thanks for listening and hope you'll tune in next week. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you found this content helpful, please like, comment, and share across your social media. Are you sick of Mind Cluck clucking up your days? Book a free initial consult with me at mindcluck.com and let's silence it. Thanks and have a great week.